And if we can give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Gabriel from the Magnolia Brown Bag Home Group.
Good evening. My name is Gabriel, and I am an alcoholic. I'd first like to apologize to this group. It's recommended to dress up when you give your story, which normally I try to take that advice, but I was devastated to find out a couple hours before coming here, nothing nice that I own fits anymore, which was very demoralizing, but I can laugh about it, and I don't have to drink about it. So this is the best I can do, and all I can do is my best. So I have a home group. It is the Westminster Reformed Presbyterian Church. We meet at 7 o'clock on Tuesday nights. It is the, help me out, Jim. I'm already freezing up. Magnolia Brown Bag. Thank you. And I have a sponsor who is kind enough to come here and support me tonight. He has a sponsor, his sponsor has a sponsor, and so on. Luckily for me, one of the recommendations is how to do this is split up into three easy categories to yap about for a couple minutes each. It all starts with what it was like. So what it was like. It wasn't that bad, actually. I'm one of nine children. My parents are not Catholic. It's always the first question. My mom just liked having kids, and my dad liked being a dad. She was a stay-at-home mom and homeschooled all nine of us kids. She's a super mom. My dad was retired Navy. He was out of the Navy by the time I was born. And, you know, was just a regular dad and really had a wonderful family, really tight-knit. Grew up in downtown Suffolk. And the street that my parents bought that house at is not the safest street. It's gotten a lot better over the years, but when we lived there, it was very not safe. And it just sort of led to a very tight-knit family. You know, we spent a lot of time with each other. You always have somebody to hang out with when you're in a family of nine, you know. And God was always very much a part of that family. My parents tried their best to instill, you know, religious values into their children, as a lot of parents do. We sat around most nights and sang songs about Jesus and went to church and stuff like that. But I think for most children, but for me anyway, it was very difficult to sort of get a grasp on this whole God thing. And growing up, you'll see how it's kind of changed over the years through through this story. But we moved out of the ghetto, if you will, and into Whaleyville when I was 10 years old. So starting those formative years right there, and it was kind of a culture shock. It was really strange to us that the kids in that neighborhood in Whaleyville played outside after dark. We're like, that is wildly dangerous, guys. You know, there's people with guns out here, and it was very different. And for the first time in my life, I actually was like part of a friend group. To back it up a little bit, I guess, like thinking back on my earlier childhood, as happy as it was and with loving parents and a big family and stuff, I was very afraid. Just of everything. Some of my earliest memories were being afraid of being left behind in a store, or general social anxieties, like having to go to children's church, vacation Bible school kind of stuff. And I just never connected with any kids my age. And there was always just sort of this fear permeating my life. And sort of had that moment really, really young. I was like 7 years old when I sort of faced with the idea of mortality. A close friend of my parents died. It was the first time I'd ever seen my parents like cry and be crushed in that way. He was a firefighter and died in a fire. So it wasn't like, you know, an old friend going a natural way. It was a real tragedy. And I guess I was always kind of a bummer of a kid, because I thought about death all the time. I was always very afraid of things. So yeah, I didn't make friends very easily. But moving out into Whaleyville, my mom kind of, I mean, she really had to push me out of the door to go and socialize with other kids and stuff, which, like I said, at the time was terrifying. But I was fortunate enough that there was sort of a friend group of boys in the Whaleyville area. There's no internet, you know, and so we all had to actually play outside with each other and in the woods and that sort of stuff. And they needed a weird kid. They needed somebody who didn't quite fit in, and I had a niche in that group. For the first time in my life, I was sort of part of something other than my family. It was sort of the start of my early codependency days. My friends became my brothers, became my life. They were everything to me. I also feel like it's worth noting that something both my parents said about me was that I was the sweetest child in the world until I learned to talk. And I always kind of took that as just like this, you know, friendly little jibe, but getting into recovery and thinking back on it, I can remember being very young and realizing, like, as I was able to start communicating with people and understanding what they were saying and I was able to talk, I could get people to do things or not do things if I could just talk them into a corner. I could be very manipulative, argumentative, and that was a habit that really stuck with me through my entire life going into recovery. I just thought that was how people did things. I didn't think there was anything weird about it. I thought everybody lied as much as I lied. I thought everybody kept secrets as much as I kept secrets. And I thought everybody liked doing that sort of thing as much as I liked doing it. What have we got here? So I was a teenager, you know, like all teenagers, there's drugs and alcohol sort of going in and out of the friend group. And be honest with you, I was never interested in it because all of my friends who did that sort of thing acted like fools. It just seemed like, you know, it didn't seem that fun. They were jumping off of porches and breaking their legs and stuff like that. I was like, I'm good. Just give me a video game. I'm sitting here safe, you know. So I was actually always considered all the way up till I was 18 years old to be the good friend, the straight-laced friend. But it was that time leading up to my 18th year that a lot of insecurities and fears really started to fester in a super unhealthy way. I noticed all my friends were like having relationships, girlfriends, boyfriends, and that sort of thing. Never, nothing. There was never any interest there. And it made me feel what my sponsor and I call less than. I was less than everybody else because I was different. And they also had these like hopes, dreams, ambitions, completely foreign to me. I had no idea what it was. People say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And they would have answers. And some of them, who I'm still friends with to this day, they not only had answers when they were like 10 years old, they went and pursued those things at a young age, excelled at them, turned them into careers, became successful people. They knew what they wanted and they went after it and they got it. Nothing. Never had any drive, never had any passion, interest in anything except playing video games and hanging out with my friends. My friends were everything. They made me feel like somebody. And the older I got, the less of a somebody I felt like because they were all sort of moving away, doing their own things. And so around 17, 18 years old, that fear really started to kick in because I'm about to graduate. You know, it was homeschool, but you know, they go make you take some tests, make sure your mom did a good job, which apparently she did, even though I cheated a lot. which once again, everybody cheats, right? And that question of what do you want? What are you going to do with yourself? Kept coming up. And I just didn't have an answer. And I knew that I was supposed to have an answer. I was supposed to have a plan, a direction for my life. But at 18, there was just this cutoff of I have no idea what I'm going to do. And I felt like there was this absolute need to have an answer to that question. So I just started telling people, hey, I'll go to college. But I had no idea what college was going to be like. I was homeschooled. Once again, the sort of social aspect of I've never been taught by a teacher other than my mother. I've never sat in a classroom full of other people and had to get to know other people and go to a school on a regular basis. It really genuinely terrified me to death. And having given people that answer, having a plan, the local Paul D. Camp Community College accepted me. But I just couldn't shake this feeling that I was headed absolutely nowhere. And that sooner or later, people were going to look back and say, oh God, what happened to Gabe? Where did Gabe go? And that really terrified me. I had friends that were already like planning on getting married, and I'd never been in a relationship. You know, I had friends who wanted to be dads. What are you talking about? I can't make a single decision for myself. All of this sort of culminated into a really interesting, wild night. I was 18, just turned 18. It was over break, so it was in between. I'm not great with dates. I think the alcohol and drug usage might have something to do with that. But I know I was on break between having graduated from high school and I wasn't yet going to college. And knowing that college was coming and this new era of my life was about to open up just scared the heck out of me. And I was hanging out with some friends who were kind of outside. There were people there that were sort of outside the core friend group, if you will, some fringe members of society in Whaleyville. And I was doing something that I had never done before, physical activity. We were playing basketball. I was never a sports kind of person, but I ended up having a really fun time playing basketball with all my friends. But it got more fun because they started busting out something called Bacardi Razz. Now, I had had tastes of alcohol when I was younger. The first one was, I was like 12 years old. Current brother-in-law, he's an ex-brother-in-law now, who was the coolest person in the world to me at the time. He was older, had been married my sister, had like a job as a mechanic, he worked on cars, he smoked cigarettes, he drank beer, but most importantly, he played video games. And he really connected with me and my brothers on that level, and we just worshiped this guy like a god. He had left out a beer. It was a Budweiser. Me and my younger brother, 2 years younger than me, my twin, basically, partner in crime, we saw it. There was nobody else around, and he kind of nudges me. We both take a sip of this beer, and I was like, yeah, no. Growing up, I was like, people drink that trash? It tastes disgusting. I'll stick to Mountain Dew. No thanks. And then seeing what it did to people, you know, and once again, my only frame of reference for the most part was young boys, you know, my friends drinking this stuff and acting a fool. My parents were not alcoholics. They got really into drinking wine for a while, but I had never seen either of my parents drunk at all, ever. And it never caused any sort of trouble or consternation in the family. But that night, drinking that Bacardi Razz, finding a drink that was really delicious. And the longer the night went on, the more that I drank, the more fun everything seemed to be. But, you know, coming from sort of a strict religious household, my parents were still, even at this time, trying to hang on to some semblance of control over their children. God bless them. We had a curfew, 10:30 at night, your boys come home. We came home, we had been drinking a little bit, but it really wasn't that bad, you know? I mean, we were getting a pretty good buzz on. And we just begged them, come on, it's Friday night, let us go play basketball for another half hour, an hour. So they're like, all right, cool, we'll give you an hour. When we went back over to the festivities, they weren't out there playing basketball. They were all in a car. And we're knocking on the window like, oh, what's going on? We were able to come back. Like, shh, get in here quick. And they're rolling up something, which at the time was legal. They called it spice. I still don't know what it was, but it's illegal now because it was like killing people. It was this real awful stuff to smoke, but this is all one night. My drugs and alcohol all just bang one night at 18 years old. I smoked that stuff, had a time lapse of about 15 minutes, have no idea what happened, and the next thing I know, my younger brother is opening the car door and is just vomiting everywhere. It was horrifying because it was the color of Bacardi Razz, which looked like blood. So I'm freaking out because I'm feeling a way that I've never felt before. And my younger brother looks like he's dying. Everybody else is just laughing. This is a fun time, you know? But I'm just freaking out. I am so afraid of how much trouble we're gonna get in and what's gonna become of all this. And I was like, okay, don't worry. I can fix all of this. Just get it out of your system. I snuck him into the house without being seen, was able to get him in bed. And he continued to puke for like the next 4 hours. It was insanity. And I gave him a bucket, he'd puke. I would go, I would empty the bucket incognito in a house full of 11 people. Somehow, we got through that entire debacle and he finally fell asleep and nobody ever knew that it happened. And I will never forget, lying in bed after he had finally fallen asleep. The disaster was averted. And after all that chaos, all that consternation, all that anxiety that that produced, I laid in that bed and I thought, I cannot wait to do this again. Because I felt like what had been missing, what I had been looking for, this directionless, purposeless life, none of it mattered anymore. It was just all gone. All of the anxieties, all of the fears, and I fit in more than I ever fit in before. I was no longer the sort of, wet blanket, don't do that, guys, don't get in trouble. I was somebody who could hold their stuff. And I would go on to prove how well I could hold that stuff the next day. I went from being the straight-laced friend to the guy, the party man. I just went in with both feet, and it was phenomenal. I started college, and I did fine. Like I said, I've always been a good student. To me, life is nothing but a quiz, a test. There's right answers, there's wrong answers. I've always been really good at it, and I felt like I had found the answer that I was looking for. Nothing mattered. It didn't matter what job I had. It didn't matter if I got married and had kids or not. It didn't matter if disaster befell me. As long as I could continue to get drunk and high, I don't care. It's fine. I have found what I'm going to do the rest of my life. And so college was wild for me. It was really wild. But it's interesting because most people, they go to college, they make all these college friends, they hang out with their college friends. I'm not in contact with a single person I went to school with in all 4 years of college because I was drunk and stoned when I showed up. I was drunk and stoned through class, and when I got off class, I was going home to get drunk and stoned with the boys, because I cared a lot about them, so I was the one that incurred all the risk. I would buy everything. I'm just a little bit older than everybody in my friend group, so I was able to legally buy alcohol before all of them, and I was far more willing to incur the risk of going and getting the other more illegal stuff so that they didn't have to. And like I said, I became very popular. After a while, this accelerated because, like I said, I did 2 years, got my associate's degree, and I was faced with that same question. Now what? What are you going to do? I was like, I know what worked last time. I told everybody I was going to go to school. So I'm going to go back to school, to Regent University, the Christian college in Virginia Beach, because I can commute there. I don't have to live there. I can still hang out with all my friends and do the things that I like to do. But it had to get even more sneaky because they would kick you out of Regent University if any of that stuff even made its way onto the campus. To which, once again, in the test of life, there was a simple solution. And my answer was, well, across the street is a Waffle House, which became my home away from home. I left, I got to school early so I could hang out at the Waffle House, eat delicious food, and drink as much as I want in my car, and then go to my apologetics class that was required and hear this guy yap on about God for hours. And right as I graduated, as literally like the week of that I took my last test, and it was like, you did it, you're gonna graduate. I was working as a taxi dispatcher in Virginia Beach, which was an awesome job. I worked the night shift, nobody else in the office. I drank and did whatever I wanted, and you answer the phone and tell people, no, we can't get you a cab. It was an awesome job. But it was like a 45-minute drive from where I lived in Whaleyville. And getting off work at like 3 o'clock, I always tried to make sure I wasn't too drunk so that I could drive home. I was very, very strict about not drinking and driving. That to me was dangerous and you shouldn't do that. So I oftentimes would just do drugs and drive. And I was in a particular rush this night because I really wanted to get home and drink. And I was smoking weed in the car, got pulled over by a cop because I was speeding. And it was the first and one of the only times really that I got in trouble for what I was doing. And I always told myself that I've seen every episode of Cops. You can lie to the cops, and it never gets you anywhere. I always said, if I'm in that position, I'll just tell them the truth. It always seems to go better for the people that tell them the truth. I lied to that cop immediately. I was so afraid, and it's my natural inclination. But I bring that up because, like I said, it was the first time that I was facing severe repercussions for my actions. And all I had to do was pass some tests for the next couple of months, which I didn't do because, as you've heard, I cheat on my tests. And when I wasn't able to pass one of those tests, they had me go to the Western Tidewater Community Service Board every week to get tested instead of every month. So all of a sudden, it's like, there's no getting around this testing thing anymore. I have to quit doing drugs. But it was interesting because it was the first time that I was sort of in a group recovery function. We were all forced to be there, and it was weird. They had heroin addicts, they had drunks, lots of drunks, drug addicts, that everybody just kind of mashed into one room. But I thought it was so fascinating watching everybody go around and talk about how they're trying and, you know, the struggles they were having. And I'll never forget this guy, although I have forgotten his name. So I call him Bob when I share my story. And his name might have been Bob for all I know. But Bob was like the worst drunk there. He just couldn't show up not drunk. And everybody told him, it's just like, dude, it's just alcohol. All you have to do is not drink the night before. Gabe can't smoke at all. He can't do any of the drugs that he was doing. But that really kind of got to me, you know, because for one thing, this guy showed up, he's just constantly puking, he's a mess, and I'm like, yeah, that's a guy with a problem. That's not me. I am not like Bob. And it also sort of illuminated the fact that alcohol is a really easy thing to do and get away with if you just do it right, if you pass that test. And that is where my drinking really took off, because I just started trying to find all sorts of things I like to drink. And I found it, and it's whiskey. Whiskey is my drink. And it was great. I was able to get through that whole period of my life, and I just drank my way through it, and it was actually kind of nice. And I was like, man, why have I been doing drugs this whole time? Like, I can drink, and most people don't even bat an eyelash. There's no smell, the test, you know, it's easy. Alcohol is the best. And I kind of do believe that in a way now, because I hear people talk about, oh, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I'm so grateful for alcohol. It used to bug me, but alcohol, at that point, really started to skyrocket all of the problems that were deeper in here, and they started coming to the surface. I really sold myself short coming out of there, because I had to do a couple days of community service. So they sent me to the Goodwill. Goodwill wanted to hire me right away. And I was like, you guys want me to come here, do easy work, you pay me a little bit of money. It was just enough that I could move out and actually live in the same house as a couple of my friends, my closest friends. So I was like, yeah, I'm living the dream. Getting paid less than minimum wage, which is just enough to afford the rent that was being very graciously offered to me by their parents. You know, so I was taking advantage of them. And here I was, a guy with a bachelor's degree in business administration, working for less than minimum wage. And I didn't see anything wrong with it at all, because it was enough to keep me drunk and keep me stoned. Things got bad quick because people were pointing out to me that, yeah, I'm selling myself short. And so that feeling of less than was really creeping up again. And I was like, okay, I can do better than this. Put myself through real estate school, became a real estate agent, and did okay at it. And the thing is with real estate is you can make a lot of money. And I would make a lot of money, and then I wouldn't work for 3 months, because I would just drink and drug that money and stay in the garage. I was living the life. I was hanging out with my friends. I was playing video games all the time. I would work a little bit, make a boatload of cash, and I would buy everybody drugs and alcohol, and it was a constant party. And yet, somehow, for some reason, all of my relationships were falling apart. The people that were closest to me didn't want to be around me anymore. And thank God for my best friend, who was the most honest person in my life at the time, who told me what the problem was. He told me, he laid out my character defects for me, you know? And I was like, oh, well, everybody else can be like this. And they're like, yeah, everybody else is not like that. And so I start trying to quit drinking and quit doing drugs. And surprisingly, the drugs was really easy to quit. I could not stop drinking. It wasn't just the DTs. Those came, but they went because I would drink because I was like, oh, that's not fun. And I don't think I made it a week. I could not make it 1 week without alcohol. And I say that was just the maximum I was able to make it. In a 6 month period, me trying to quit, I was like 24. I could make it a day and then I had to drink more. And it started to really scare me, but not enough to talk to anybody about it, not enough to get help. And finally, I had really pushed my best friend to his limit and he was just tired of my crap. And he told me one day, look, we both know you're crazy. He knows me better than anybody else on the planet. He's known me since I was 10 years old. And he told me straight up, we both know you're crazy. And I did not argue with him at all because I know. I don't talk about it with anybody else, but he knew. He said, have you ever thought of getting help? And I don't know what he was suggesting at the time. I think he was just saying, just God, get somebody to help you out because I can't help you and this is terrible to live with. I don't want to be around you anymore. And it started getting me to think about this whole help thing. And it all sort of came to a head. Luckily, it was nothing crazy dramatic, you know. I didn't hurt anyone, didn't kill anyone. You know, I annoyed everybody to high heaven. But I was on my way to an open house, and because I was trying to make some money. I had run out of money again, and hadn't drank in around 48 hours. And much like I was supposed to tonight, you know, you show up in an open house, you're supposed to look kind of nice. You know, and at the last couple of open houses, I did not look nice. I put on tons of weight. I sweated alcohol. Like, you could smell the alcohol on me when I was at these open houses and talking to clients and stuff. So business was not good. Nobody wanted to work with me. And I was on the way to this particular open house, and I had to pull over in a church parking lot and vomit all over the place. And laying back in my car, being late for my open house, swishing my mouth out, I was just like, this is absolutely nuts. I'm going to die. I felt like I was going to die at that point. I had developed something I wouldn't wish on even the worst person in the world, irritable bowel syndrome. And I've been suffering from that for many months because just my habits, you know, both eating, drinking, and the occasional drugs was just destroying my insides. And it was hell. It was absolute hell. And fortunately for me, I knew one person in my life that I had seen go through this before. Well, two. One was Bob, and he was actually the first person I thought of. I thought, oh my God, I always thought I would never be Bob, and here I am. I can't make it more than 48 hours without, you know, looking like he did. And the other person was my older brother, Benjamin, who had gotten sober, and he'd been sober for, I think at that point, coming up on 2 years. It was right around 2 years he'd been sober, and I knew he got sober in this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Not telling his story, but he's a big part of it. You know, a couple years prior to that, when I moved out and stuff, my parents were having terrible trouble with Ben. He also was somebody who did not belong, did not fit in, and felt less than. He was autistic, which is a pretty common term nowadays. And on the spectrum where he fell, he could fool a lot of people into thinking that he was, as he liked to say, a totally normal person. He drove, he could keep down a job and stuff, but all that went to hell when he, you know, couldn't stop drinking. And I gave him a call, and I was just like, hey, you know those AA meetings you go to? Yeah. Think I might maybe need to go to one just once. And I feel like he had been waiting for this call for a long time. Because he said, there's a meeting just down the street from where you live tonight. It was a Friday night, and it was the Friday night discussion group, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, St. Paul's Episcopal Church. And I try not to drag this part on too long because it is like years of me dragging my feet after that first day in AA. Because once again, it was just a room full of, well, I expected a room full of Bobs. And what I got was all these laughing, smiling people who, like, they seemed fine. I was like, there's nothing wrong with you people, you know? And I was just like, this is not for me. This is not my place. I saw the steps. I saw God. And I was like, nope, this isn't going to work, you know, because I'm not doing those steps. And I'm not talking to anybody else about what's going on in here. I've never talked to anybody about it before. I'm not about to start doing it now. But maybe there's something in here, in this room, a prayer that they say, a certain thing that they do, something I can steal from these people that I can integrate into my life so that I can drink and drug normally. Which, yeah, you laugh at because you know how that goes. And I tried that, and it was this really long period. I mean, it was years, if I'm being honest, and we'll get to that, of 1 foot out the door. Once again, that fear, that anxiety, that feeling of less than was skyrocketed at this point, as high as it had ever been. Because now I'm sitting in rooms full of people, you know, once a week was all I ever did at that Friday night discussion group. And I'm unwilling, completely unwilling to do anything that they asked me to do. But they are pushy at the Friday night discussion group. They told me two things, keep coming back. I was like, okay, I'm fine with that. You guys are just down the street, you know, and it helps me not drink on Friday nights. That's an improvement. That's how I looked at things. But they also kept telling me to get a sponsor. And this is where the rubber really met the road. I asked this guy to sponsor me, who I had heard talk at the Friday night discussion group a couple times, never spoke to him before. He said yes on the dot. Said, let's have coffee and talk it over first, but yeah, I'm willing to do this. And I was like, oh, okay. And I picked the guy because to me, he seemed like a pushover. He seemed like somebody I could lie to, somebody I could manipulate, and I could get all these people off my back saying, get a sponsor, be like, I got a sponsor, but I'm the guy in control of this relationship. He had sponsored like hundreds of people. And he told me right off the bat, there's nothing you're going to say to me that's going to make me surprised or make me walk out that door in disgust. And I was like, cool, don't believe you, don't care, I'm not talking to you about that stuff. But I fed him a bunch of BS, and he called me on it. He's just like, I don't believe you. I don't think you actually believe that. Is that the truth? If I had a dollar for every time my first sponsor asked me, is that the truth? I would never have to work again. And that's how delusional I was. Like, I just wasn't honest about anything. And very slowly, I think about 6 months into our sponsor relationship, finally, I was just getting so tired of the way that my life was going and how, you know, and I was starting to actually get jealous of people in the program because I started to believe after a while that you guys are for real and that you were alcoholic like I was alcoholic. And you did have the trouble like I had the trouble. And a lot of you, way worse. Like I said, I'm fortunate. I got in young. I started kind of late, you know, people sharing their stories about drinking at 12 years old and stuff. I was just like always finding a way to compare myself out. But just at that Friday night discussion group, there was enough people sharing just little tidbits of my story, ways that people think, ways that how they couldn't sleep at night because their mind would continue to race. And that little door of open-mindedness started to crack just a little bit. And I finally asked my sponsor, what are you doing? Why did you say yes to this? Why do you continue to buy me lunch when we meet? He drove 40 minutes to me. I didn't drive to him. He always drove to me because he knew I was broke. He knew I had no money to travel to him, no money to pay for food at IHOP. And I asked him, I was just like, why are you doing this? Why are you so willing to put up with this? And like, I had started to get more honest with him and actually tell him about some stuff that was going on and why I believed I drank and stuff like that. And he told me, he just said, somebody else did it for me and I love you. And I was just like, all right, guy, like, you don't even know me. And what you do know, you should not love me. You know that I lie to you all the time. You know, I'm wasting your time, yada, yada. And I just will never forget that because the longer I'm in AA, the more I see that whole attitude of somebody else did it for me. And I've heard it said, it's not one of the most common sayings, at least that I've heard in AA, but I like it. It's, we're going to love you till you love yourself. Unfortunately, he had to move. And he told me, he was just like, gotta move. I said, what an incredibly selfish thing of you to do. He said, yeah, but I want you to get a new sponsor, and I don't want you to stop talking to me until you get a new sponsor. I saw an out. I saw a way to break away clean from AA. I didn't have anybody's phone numbers. People knew me at the Friday night discretion group, you know, but like, it was just me and Jeff was the name of my sponsor. It was just me and Jeff, like, that was it. And I was like, this guy's moving away. He's taking everything I've told him all the way up to Charlottesville. Clean slate, baby. And at this point, I had actually not drank for, I think it was around 3 months at this time. I was on a hot streak. It was the most I'd gone without drinking since the basically 18 years old. And I told him, I said, all right, I'll get a sponsor and then I'll stop talking to you. So funny enough, I actually came here and I asked you to be my sponsor. And being a good sponsor, he said, yes, here's my number. Call me and we'll get started. I didn't call him, called Jeff, said, hey, I got a new sponsor, so everything's gonna be okay. And I never called you again. Clean break. Nobody's gonna miss me. I wasn't part of a home group, you know, and I'd been in and out at this point for so long that, you know, people just knew I disappeared for long periods of time. I really got my stuff together. I started to lose weight, quit smoking cigarettes, moved out of my friend's house, got my own place, you know, and really started trying to get my act together. And I can remember the irritability, the restlessness, the discontent just slowly building up. And it didn't make sense to me because it's like, you're doing it. You're doing the grown-up stuff. You're paying your own bills. And it's not, you know, a friend of the family who's giving you insanely cheap rent. You're paying proper rent like everybody else, you know. You're struggling out there. You're making it work. You're in real estate, you know, you got your head shot, like things are headed in the right direction. You're losing weight, you know, you're making your own life for yourself, this thing that had scared you for so long. But I ended up drinking again. It was something, I was just angry. Couldn't even tell you what it was over, but I started drinking again and it was immediately back to what it was, like from the earliest worst days, and got sick again. And I knew I had to come back. And AA, immediately picked a sponsor, kind of the same way I did last time, except this time I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it proper, you know. But in between that time, I did leave out sort of an important detail, and I forgot to mention at the beginning, too. On August 23rd, 2019, I took my last drink, and it was the night my brother Ben died. He had a stroke. He was 30 years old, super rare sort of thing. Obviously surprising and devastating. And just about that time, things like really started to be brightening up in my life. You know, I was actually starting to work the steps with Jeff. This was shortly before he moved away. And I mean, obviously it was one of the worst, you know, experiences of my life. He was in a coma for like a week, didn't sleep that whole week, spent the entire time at the hospital. And the night that they decided that it was over, there was nothing to do, and that he'd been basically dead for the last 6 days and they were gonna pull the plug, my parents sent all of us home and somebody busted out some drinks. And I just couldn't deal with it. I could not deal with the unfairness of it all. We had grown very close in our time in the program together, and I had a brother in every sense of the word. And just like that, it was gone. It was so unfair. I was so furious, I was so angry, and I hadn't slept in days, and I could not live with the fact that just a couple miles away, they were basically giving up, ending his life. And I drank myself to sleep on my parents' couch. I woke up to the sound of my mom coming home and just howling. It sounded like a wounded animal. I'll never forget what it sounds like. And the entire family was right where they were supposed to be. They were surrounding her, everybody was grieving together as a unit. And I was just groggily waking up to this because I was drunk on the couch. I have not had a drop of alcohol since that day, but that's not my sobriety date. It continued to be a rocky road from there. It was difficult, but my new sponsor, who was very patient with me, much like my first one, started to make some progress. it's difficult to explain what it was like, because I feel like a lot of people come into AA and they quit drinking, things get better. I came into AA, it was a rocky road, ended up quitting drinking, things were getting better, and then I had to start all over again. And it was the most miserable year. It was just awful, even though I wasn't drinking, because I had to deal with all this other stuff with losing a loved one. And very slowly, you know, things got better, but I heard somebody share at a meeting this week, actually, there's a huge difference between being willing and being entirely ready. And as difficult as that night was, it apparently was not painful enough for me to become entirely ready. And it was, double check my date here, March 28th, 2023. I had the opportunity to do hallucinogenic drugs, which was something I really liked to do back in the day. And I did it because I was, once again, angry. I was irritable, discontent. Hadn't drank at this point for around 3 years. It was a nice little streak that I was on. But I was never fully in, you know? I was always looking for that out, not really fully dedicated to any aspect of the program whatsoever. And it ended up with me going to jail. Like, it was a wild night. It was terrible. Being in a jail cell on hallucinogenic drugs is not fun. There's a whole big old court case over it. And, you know, obviously I got out of it and everything. But it was interesting because when I came home from jail, still sort of tripping, I just knew what I had to do. I had to call and tell my sponsor what happened. And I had to throw away 3 years of sobriety and start from scratch. But it was just different this time. It's hard to explain, but I was entirely ready. There's a lot of things that I didn't like talking to my sponsor about. And I might mention, oh yeah, this is a thing, but we're not really going to talk about it. And there was plenty of things that I was still holding inside and unwilling to bring out into the open at all. And I realized, I was like, I don't think I have any lives left. I think next time I'm going to really hurt somebody, I'm going to really hurt myself, or it's just going to be the last strike for me. But mostly I was just tired, you know, sick and tired, being sick and tired, as they say. I was so tired. And ever since then, life has just been phenomenal. So I guess that kind of brings me to what it's like now, because that's what it was like. Like I said, some people, they come in, and it's just like, oh, it was great, and I had my first meeting, and zoom, off to the races. I had a very, very bumpy story, and some of it was outside of my control. Losing a brother like that, it had nothing to do with anything I did, but it was something I had to deal with, and didn't deal with it in the best way. And I think if I didn't have the program at the time, things would be very different. But this last year, coming up on 2 years, actually, it's incredible how time flies. It's just been the best time of my life. I went from having this really vague sort of idea of, you know, you hear it mentioned, a vengeful God. But to me, it was a teacher. It was somebody who, you know, is handing me a quiz and giving me A and B answers. And I'm constantly either cheating or getting the answer wrong, making him mad, and he's punishing me by taking my brother away, or I'm getting in trouble for drinking and drugging, and I'm not, you know, like all the people I compare myself to really developing and working on an idea of a power greater than myself that lives with me and doesn't hate me and actually loves me. And I think a lot of the value I get out of that is the ability to love myself, which is something I had never done before until the last couple of years. And so once again, AA was right. You guys loved me until I loved myself. Put up with a lot of in and out. It's amazing to me how often I walked out of this program, came back, picked up a white chip. I'm sure people were like, he's never gonna get it. He's just one of those, you know? And you know, my friend Kirk, you know, he likes to say some people, it hasn't hurt enough. And I guess I had my breaking point, but I've also learned from all of my experiences that you can always dig deeper. I can always go lower. And it's very easy to go lower. I'm one drink away, I'm one drug away from going to an even worse place than I've ever been. So as much as fear has been a part of my life, I have a different sort of fear now. It's a healthier fear against getting drunk or stoned again, because I don't want to do that to the people that are around me. I don't want to do that to myself, because I actually care about myself now. And the sort of fears I used to have, which, don't get me wrong, are very much there. Things like standing up in front of a bunch of people and telling them all these embarrassing stories about yourself and all your insecurities. That was a lot of the reason I liked to jump out of AA. Once AA started getting too real and people were hinting that, oh, well, maybe you share your story, or why don't you share more? You know, oh, here, take my number. I was like, I gotta get out of here. I gotta get out. But AA is the best thing in my life. Like I said, I've got a sponsor. We talk multiple times a week. Our step work, which oftentimes isn't step work, it's just kind of riffing, you know, going, what's going on today, this week, you know. I don't know how I lived a life without being able to be honest with somebody. You know, being as sick as your secrets and being 30 years old and 30 years of secrets built up, I was sick and I just can't do it anymore. And if you ever want to move to Charlottesville, I got news for you. I'm getting another sponsor and I will actually work the steps right away, because this is vital to my way of life. And as much as I look down on it and I looked at all these bobs and I'm like, I don't want to be like those people. You know, my heroes when I was younger were always like famous people, rock stars and stuff like that. You know, you sort of average stuff. The people I look up to in the world more than anybody else, by a pretty wide margin now, all sit in rooms like this and do stuff like this. And it's just such a far cry from the way I used to look at anybody, you know. And because of all of that, I'm able to be something that I never thought I would be, worth something. I have something to give. I have something that can benefit people, even if it's just a story that I sort of slap out there in 45 minutes. It's something. And I know it's something because somebody else gave it to me. And I know how it's affected me over the years. And that had to be instilled into me, that idea that you have self-worth, you have value, you have something to give people, maybe even a purpose in life. And especially when I think about Ben, which I have a lot this week, because, you know, I'm thinking about my story and this coming up. Try not to overthink it, but I just can't help it. I even had a dream about him this week, you know. I just think it's incredible that, like me, somebody like him who had this sort of an actual, you know, learning disability and always thought he was going to have nothing to give anybody else in this world, saved my life. He was the hand that reached back out. And I wish I had more time to tell you about the conversations that just he and I had. He really was my first sponsor, but he was so good at AA. He always said, I cannot be your sponsor. Like, I'm your brother. It will not work. He was a real pushy one when it came to getting a sponsor. But he told me things like, you don't drink because you have problems. You have problems because you drink. No, it's the other way around. Sorry, you don't have problems because you drink. You drink because you have problems. And until you start talking to somebody about those problems, dealing with those problems, you're always going to go to that solution, the drink. And he was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. And because of that, like I said, I'm able to do something like this that normally would have had me running for the hills saying, forget that, I'm never doing that. I go to a lot of meetings. I'm set in my ways. I've got the meetings I like, and on a good week, I'm doing a meeting or meeting with my sponsor 6 or 7 times a week. You know, and it's just my lifeblood. It, at the very least, it gets me out of the house. I might hear something that is hugely beneficial for me. I might share something that's hugely beneficial for someone else. As part of the annoyance early on was that nobody knows. Nobody knows. Part of the reason I got into real estate was I wanted to be the center of attention. I saw Ryan Finch, he was my broker that I worked under. I saw his face on a billboard and I was like, that's what I'm working towards. I want people to know. I want them to see me in a suit, Mr. Success. And now I've got this life that it's almost indescribable what AA has given me in this sense of purpose and this ability to be of worth. And it's this little secret society, it's this enormous secret society that it doesn't hold any aplomb or praise, you know, or fame to it, but that's part of what makes it work so well, because I'm not doing this AA thing anymore because I want to make my mom happy or I want people to see that I've gotten my stuff together. I'm just doing it because I think it is genuinely the most incredible thing in the world. And if you've ever heard me share at a meeting, you've probably heard me share this, and I'll share it 1,000 more times. I think most people spend their entire lives looking for what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous, a place where people know my name, I know theirs, they're happy to see me, I'm happy to see them, and we help each other. Sometimes, most of the time, just getting through the day. And that concept too of just a day at a time is life-changing for me. Gratitude, counting my blessings, from another book that was recommended to me by an AA, rejoicing in your uniqueness. You know, the fact that I'm different than all my friends, the fact that Ben was different than most of society, just means that I'm more unique and have something to give that maybe all those normies don't. And it is interesting, having compared myself to others my entire life, how often nowadays my friends look at me and go, I wish I had something like that. And here I've been running away from it for so many years. So all that to say, see if I skipped anything. Oh, there was one thing. Yeah, I guess I got 5 minutes left. I thought today's daily reflection was just sort of appropriate for what I had to do today, you know? It wasn't what I was planning on talking about, you know, service and what I do in AA, because I don't sponsor anybody yet. I've held a couple different service positions, and I'm probably going to pick up another one soon. But I really believe that, like, a big part of service is involved is just being there. I can't tell you how comforting it is to show up to the same meeting week after week and see that somebody who is struggling with my disease, sometimes in a lot worse, usually in a lot worse circumstances, they're still going. And I get to listen to what's helping them keep going. And I get to steal that wisdom and use it in my own life. It's huge to me. And sometimes I don't even have to share. Like, just seeing the people there, that ministry of presence is enough. You know, we don't all have to be sponsors or involved in, you know, high levels of or low levels, depending on how you look at it, of the service structure. I think a big part of serving in AA is show up, share, and listen, and just be there for the other person. But the reflection today was there's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. To be helpful is our only aim. I understand that service is a vital part of recovery, but I often wonder, what can I do? Simply start with what I have today. I look around to see where there is a need. Are the ashtrays full? Do I have hands and feet to help empty them? Suddenly, I'm involved. The best speaker may be may make the worst coffee. The member who's best with newcomers may be unable to read. The one willing to clean up may make a mess of the bank account, yet every one of these people and jobs is essential to an active group. The miracle of service is this. When I use what I have, I find there is more available than I ever realized before. And I'm very, very grateful for being asked to share my story here tonight, because in a big way, this is what I have. I was talking with Donna before we got started. I really believe AA at its core is stories. People resonate with stories, and if we're lucky, we see ourselves in stories and we can be influenced by stories. And so as long as we keep telling stories here, I'm going to keep showing up and I'm going to keep listening. Thanks for letting me share.